My name is Evelyn Thorne. I'm 25 years old. Today's date is September 20th, 2014. We are in the San Francisco Public Library, and I just met Anthony as a volunteer.
I'm Anthony Tusler, 67 years old. Today is September 20th, 2014, and I'm in the StoryCorps booth in the San Francisco Public Library. And I just met Evelyn sitting out at the table there.
Alrighty. Well, you know, we got to talking, and I know that you are involved with the disability rights movement, and you said that it kind of dovetails the civil rights movement. So if you wanted to start off there, that would be great.
Generally, what I'd like to do is start off growing up as a disabled kid.
Yeah.
And when I was injured in 1952, I went back to school about 9 months later. My elementary school, fortunately, the first three grades were on the ground floor, and my mother fought like mad to get me to be able to go to that school. And it wasn't easy, but they did allow me to. And that's really what it was like in the 1950s if you one had a disability. If you could get through the front door, generally they wouldn't throw you out. Mm. But they wouldn't provide anything else to be able to make it easy for you to be able to go to school, for somebody like myself to go to school. So what happened to me when I got to the fourth grade, which was on the second floor, I had to learn to use braces and crutches to be able to climb the stairs to get to the fourth grade. And that's a perfect example of what was happening in those days in the United States, well, around the world probably, but in the United States for people with disabilities, is it was up to us to figure out a way to get upstairs.
Mm.
It was not the responsibility of the environment of the school to be able to deal with the stairs, either put in an elevator or, as they do these days, just move the fourth grade down to the first floor rather than have it on the second floor. If they had have done that, I would have been able to keep using my wheelchair and been able to go to school. But instead, I spent a couple of years learning how to use braces and crutches and climbing stairs. And so it's really, I mean, the reason I talk about that is because that is the shift that happened in the disability rights movement. I mean, that's what we brought to the table in the, really in the early 70s, was that shift from, if you have stairs, what do you do with them? Do you design a better wheelchair? Do you do another operation on the person so that maybe certain muscles will work better? That's the way it was. And two, maybe put it in a ramp. Mm. That's how we deal with stairs these days, is either an elevator or a ramp. And we start designing things so we don't need so many stairs. And the exciting thing that happened with that is that once we started putting in ramps, we started to realize it worked for all kinds of people, not just wheelchair users.
Right.
But people pushing baby carriages, delivery people, whoever, the ramps worked for them as well.
Were you the only person living with a disability in your school?
I was the only person that I knew. I mean, I'm sure that there were others, as Evelyn and I were talking earlier. From what I can tell, about 75-80% of people with disabilities, it's non-visible. So I'm sure that there are kids who had something going on with them, but certainly I was the identified disabled person in the school. And that's pretty much the way it was for me all the way until I got involved in the disability rights movement in the early 70s. And that's why I wrote down in my card that I've been a person with a disability since 1952, but I've really seen myself as a disabled person since the early 70s.
Mm.
So as I was growing up, I was as independent as possible, as mainstreamed as possible, and I pretended that I didn't have a disability, even though it was obvious that I did, because I had full leg braces and aluminum crutches. I mean, obviously I was disabled, but I pretended that I wasn't because I didn't want to be one of those people.
Mm.
One of those people, one of those poor, pitiful groups that didn't have any fun, that would be shut away, you know, that wouldn't be a part of life. I mean, because that's what happened to a lot of disabled people, is that they were warehoused. Mm. They were out of the public gaze. And they weren't allowed to participate in life the way I wanted to. You know, I mean, I was a child of the 60s. I'm a baby boomer. I'm at the beginning of the baby boom. And I mean, the 60s were a phenomenal time of change, both politically as well as socially. And I was a part of that. You know, I grew my hair long. I started smoking dope. You know, I was one of those that helped change how society, that helped change society, both politically and socially. I mean, I went on anti-war marches. I was part of a group called Vietnam Summer, where we were advocating for ending the war in Vietnam. I worked with some civil rights groups around African Americans' right to integration. You know, so I had, plus I came out of the classic liberal, middle-class white American family, you know, that was, didn't believe in racism, even though we were, you know, didn't believe in sexism, although, of course, we were. But, you know, good liberals. And so I grew up looking at the world partially through a political lens, through a liberal political lens. Mm. And so by the time I got involved in the disability rights movement, I had all this experience and worldview that suddenly came into focus. And it was like, oh, my God, I'm one of these people. And this, mm-hmm. it all made sense. It all fit. And so I spent the 60s avoiding other disabled people. I went to high school, was mainstreamed. What they did allow me was to park in the faculty parking lot. And I didn't have to take gym. And I got to leave class 5 minutes early so that I could get to the next class, because it was one of those huge Southern California schools where it just took forever to get from one class to the other. And there I was on my braces and crutches, you know, in the Southern California smog and heat, you know, going from class to class, unlike everybody else in the smog and heat. And so, and there weren't any disabled students that I knew at that high school. Yeah. You know, 4,200 students, and I didn't see any other disabled students.
Wow.
You know, and I only saw a handful of African-American students, and there's maybe about 20 Latino students. You know, it's just this. Pasadena is an incredibly segregated town in terms of where people live. And so that's when busing happened. That's one of the places they did busing. Marshall, the school across town, was Muir was the black high school. I went to PHS, the white high school. You know, there's incredible separation of races. So all I saw was white people and no disabled people. Eventually, though, well, I graduated from high school, went to Pasadena City College for a couple of years, and continued to be involved in political and social activity. We formed a little clan of people. The name escapes me at the moment. I'll get back to it. I went to Pasadena City College for a year, but then came north. I wanted to get out of L.A. and went to Sonoma State College. And there were a couple of wheelchair users, and I avoided them. I really didn't want to know them. I didn't want to be a part of them. To me, if we were seen together, that would blow my cover. That would mean that I was one of them. You know, it's like I saw back in the 80s when women were coming into the work world pretty, you know, into managerial positions. You know, I'd go to a conference and women would avoid each other because if they saw two of them together, it would be like, oh, there they are. I mean, fortunately, it's a lot better now. But it was the same thing for me as a disabled person in the world. I didn't want to be pointed to and say, there they are.
Yeah.
Because the idea to have a disability identity, in my mind, was to have a really negative identity. You know, a Jerry Lewis kind of identity of, you know, this poor, crippled, trapped individual who's going to die soon. You know, and I didn't want any part of that. And what happened was a couple of things kind of came together in little ways. I started noticing the curb cuts. Those are the concrete ramps that go from the sidewalk to the streets. I noticed them in Berkeley, And I didn't realize their wheelchair users had made those happen.
Oh.
You know, I thought it was people, you know, mothers with baby carriages, because I didn't think disabled people could be political. But I ran into a guy on the street who kind of made me start realize that there's something changing here, the way he talked to me. And then I went out to Sonoma State and I met Steve Diaz, who was a dear friend of mine. He died about a year ago. Steve was a wheelchair user. He had a sardonic black sense of humor. And most importantly, he was cooler than I was. And all of my life growing up, well, and continuing to this very day, I want to be cool. To be uncool, just to my mind, is the worst possible thing. And so to find a disabled person who was cooler than I am, than I was, suddenly made me realize that I could be a disabled person, that I could take on that identity, be as cool as I needed to be, and I had a home. I had a home for my heart. I had a home for my politics.
Mm.
I had a home for who I knew, who I loved, who I dated. All of a sudden, it all came together. Almost like when you have a super cooled liquid that's still liquid, but you put a little crystal in it, and all of a sudden it goes,
yeah,
and turns into ice. It was just like that. It was like that. Diaz was that little crystal that went, and I became, you know, it all fit for me. You know, it wasn't always real easy, but it was a phenomenal change and a way for me to put my burden down.
Mm.
You know, because to be closeted, there's always a cost to be closeted. I mean, there's times. I mean, if I was gay and living in Montana and out in the sticks, I would probably not be out, because the cost of being out, that cost is far higher than the cost of being closeted. But there's still a cost to that being closeted.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me as a closeted disabled person, to be able to put that burden down was wonderful. You know, it was liberating, it was really freeing. And it, for me, my only ambition was to get a job so that I would have enough money to pay rent, to be able to go to the bar, have a beer. I mean, I was one of those beer-drinking, pool-shooting hippies who lived in Cotati, and that was my ambition in life. You know, why should I do it? Why should I want any more than that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seemed like a good life. But it was because a lot of who I was kind of blocked off from me. When that moment came, when I was able to embrace my disability identity, then suddenly the world opened up to me. And before I knew it, I had a career. You know, and it's been a wonderful ride this last 41 years. So what happened to me was, Steve and I started organizing the disabled students at Sonoma State. We started hanging out together socially. You know, I dated a number of the women who were in that group. We had a club on campus, the Disabled Students Coalition, and Steve and I were getting that club established. And I said, "Okay, what's the mission for this group?" And Steve said, "Knock shit off the shelves." And it's a good way to describe what we saw, as we saw ourselves, what they call here in the 2014, disruptors. Mm. It was our job to disrupt how the university operated with disabled students in particular. And so we, as the Disabled Students Club Coalition, that's what we set out to do. And so we did. We came together. We brought other students in. We advocated with the school. We discovered other groups in other state colleges that were advocating. I remember going to a meeting down in San Jose, and there was and I can't even remember who organized it, but it was the other disabled students from the California State University system. And so there maybe was 60, 80 people with disabilities in this room, and I'd never been in a room with that many disabled people in my life.
Mm.
And I was just stunned. You know, my brain was fried. I probably was not the same for a couple of days because it was just, it's such a, I had spent so long being one thing and then to be something else. You know, it shifts things, you know, on a deep emotional level. I go to the Society for Disability Studies every year. It's an international conference. And it's really exciting, and there's a lot of heady intellectual stuff at SDS. But there's also, because there's a lot of disabled people, I end up dealing with a lot of deep emotional stuff. And usually when I come back from SDS, I'm a mess. I got to just chill for 4 or 5 days just to be able to, for the pieces to come back together again. So that's what it was like walking into that room. It was just the pieces went all asunder.
Mm.
And that was part of my coming to be, to really embracing my disability identity. So Steve and I advocated with the university and the coalition did to fund a position to coordinate disability services at Sonoma State. And I suddenly discovered that I had ambition to go beyond just being a beer-drinking, pool-shooting hippie. And I wanted that job. I helped write the job description. We made sure that Steve was on the hiring committee. We had an ally at the time. I mean, the reason that so much of this came together was there's a woman, self-identified, able-bodied, who she worked for the Dean of Students and had in her portfolio a couple of different things, like she had to organize commencement. And I think she was prescient enough to see that students with disabilities were not being well served. And so she was the one that kind of helped pull people together in a really... We all right? She was really prescient. She pulled people together, disabled students, to be able to start working on these issues. And she did it in a, she was the best ally. I mean, because once it took hold, once Steve and I started to figure out what it was we wanted to do, she stepped aside.
Mm.
In so many situations like that, that able-bodied person does not step aside. You know, they want to still continue to help. And so those people are the ones who then become the coordinator of the services.
Yeah.
But at Sonoma State, she was Joanne Schechter. She stepped aside. Steve was on the hiring committee, and I got hired into the position. You know, I actually had a real honest-to-God job. You know, it was with retirement benefits, with health care. I'm in a real J-O-B. I mean, just an incredible thing to have. And so that was the beginning. That was 1975. Things had been happening in Berkeley. They really, the disability rights movement, as we know it here on the West Coast, and we claim to be the home of disability rights in the United States. Boston has a good claim to it, as does a couple of other cities, but with the great man theory of disability, Berkeley gets the nod. So if you read the texts, this is where it started. And it was about 1968 when five guys, wheelchair users, came together at UC Berkeley. And when they graduated, they needed to do something. They were very political. They'd formed an office on their campus. They found some federal funds to fund it. So they graduated, and it's like, what are they going to do now? So they formed the Center for Independent Living, which was a nonprofit by and for people with disabilities that provided a number of core services like peer counseling, wheelchair repair, housing advocacy. CIL still exists. It's in Berkeley, and it's the model for independent living centers across the United States. So the program they started at Berkeley, PDSP, Physically Disabled Students Program, just because we were disability rights advocates didn't mean that we were okay with hanging out with people with intellectual disabilities or emotional disabilities.
Mm.
So they named themselves Physically Disabled Students Program to make it clear they were not, dare I say it, retarded.
Hmm.
You know, they wanted to make really clear distinction that it would who it was. And part of that was to define ourselves because it was so rare. I mean, the only groups like this were veterans, you know, and there's some wheelchair basketball and some things like that, but there was no model within the disability community of disabled people coming together and working for ourselves and being in control of what we did. And so I think that this is just supposition on my part, that that's part of the reason it was physically disabled students program,
mm.
was to make that clear what it was they were all about. And so me being in Sonoma, you know, we're about 50 minutes from Berkeley, 50 minutes from San Francisco, came down to Berkeley on a regular basis. I remember calling up PDSP and asking them what kind of records they kept on their students. What I did was, at some point I figured, well, we better know who the students are that we're serving. And so I had 6x8 cards that had their name, their address, telephone number. It might have had their disability, but that was about it. And I called up PDSP and I said, what records are you guys keeping? And it turns out they're keeping about that same level of records. Unlike, say, if we went to the health center at Sonoma State or went to the counseling department, where there'd be much, much more detailed records. To my mind, always, and it's still true, is that the kind of record keeping where when you go into a doctor's office and you have to fill out endless forms,
mm-hmm.
that's a model that I don't think we should have in providing disability services. Because it's an individual focus, focusing on what's happening, what the problems reside with the individual if you do case memo notation and have all of those kinds of records.
Mm-hmm.
The problem's not with the individual. The problem's the environment they live in. They may not be adjusting to that environment particularly well, but a lot of what it's about is putting the focus on the environment. I mean, like I talked about, that difference between climbing stairs to the fourth grade or moving the fourth grade down to the first floor. That's that profound difference, is that the problem doesn't lie with us. The problem lies out there in the world. The problem is not that I need more job training necessarily, although it's certainly not going to hurt for me to be employed. It's for employers to start hiring us.
Mm.
You know, the problems are is discrimination in the workplace. You know, flat out. I've worked in the human HR department, the personnel department at Sonoma State for 3 years. And I saw how the university discriminated against people with disabilities.
Hmm.
You know, it's very subtle, but it works. You know, and people are very sophisticated about their discrimination these days. They say all the right words, but they do the same old things, which is discriminating against people and exclude them. And so that's where the problems lie. You know, I as an individual, as a disabled individual, I have the responsibility to take care of my own life, to be in charge of my life, to make sure that I do the things that I need to do. I mean, I need to pay my bills on time. I need to put a roof over my head. I need to have a job that pays the rent. And I do that within a context of a world that doesn't make that particularly easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it a lot easier for me being a white middle-class male. You know, I have white privilege, male privilege, middle-class privilege. And so all of that's made it possible, but I don't have able-bodied privilege. And so there's many places and times when to have a disability, it's a liability for me because of people's attitudes and their stereotypes. It is not an easy world to be in. It's soft discrimination generally. Generally, the way the exclusion works is to set the bar so low for people with disabilities, not to keep the bar where everybody else is. So soft discrimination says that if, as a disabled person, you get a job, and the bar is set low, you're not going to get promoted because everybody's going to know that you don't have the skills. You know, we do not hold people with disabilities to the same standards. So a lot of that happens, as well as just outright exclusion.
Hmm.
You know, the numbers of times I've seen managers unwilling to change very slight parts of the job description so that disabled people could do the job. I mean, it is phenomenal numbers of times I've seen that.
Do you have an example?
Let me get back to that.
Yeah.
'Cause that one of the things that's true for me is that I tend to be an optimist when I'm out in the world. And so I was doing a training the other day, and the director of the program said, well, when do you get mad? And for the life of me, I could not remember the last time I had been mad as a disabled person. And that's because that's kind of the way that I get through the world. And studies show that if you have a smile on your face and you're happy and you're optimistic, better things happen to you than if you're pessimistic and you're frowning. But that also means I'm not readily in touch with the negative kinds of things. And so, of course, a week later, a day later, I was able to remember five or six times when I was really pissed off by being a disabled person. You know, going down to my local post office and seeing somebody who didn't have a disability parking in the blue parking space. You know, and when I said to the person, as nice as it could be, you forgot to put your blue placard up showing that you could park there. The woman said, it doesn't matter. He'll take care of it. And she was pointing to her husband, who was not disabled either. She was just trying to put me off. And so I think I said something more like, well, you really shouldn't be parking there then. Well, when I left, I went in and picked up my mail. As I was leaving the post office, I was so irritated by this car, I turned around with my cell phone and started to take a picture. And as I walked away, or as I was going away in my wheelchair, the guy yelled at me, who was in the car, and I turned around. He yelled at me so he could flip me off.
Mm.
You know, and so it was that made me very angry. But when I was doing that training, I wasn't able to access that anger.
And do you think that has anything to do with perceptions about the disability community or, kind of external mainstream culture not having space for disability, folks living with disabilities to be angry about unjust things?
I'm probably I'm bicultural in that I'm competent in the disability culture as well as the able-bodied culture, but I am actually more competent in the able-bodied culture because that's the way I grew up. That's the way I was socialized. And I would guess that part of my inability to access that anger is that I don't want to be characterized as that angry cripple, because that's one of the stereotypes. You know, and the stereotypes I want to access to be able to get through the world is to be the competent, happy, smiling, outgoing, disabled person. Because that's a stereotype that is, I get a lot more out of that than being the angry cripple who's going to be excluded. And so, yeah, that's part of the compartmentalization that probably happens with me, is because how I was socialized growing up. So it's happened to me. Eventually, I broke through the glass ceiling at Sonoma State. That's when I ended up working in HR. Got a nice pay bump and didn't work on that much disability stuff and hated it. You know, because by this time, you know, in the mid-90s, my heart was in disability. My heart, my stomach, my head was in disability rights, disability culture. I was not particularly interested in doing other kinds of things. You know, injury and illness prevention training didn't interest me a whole lot. So I lasted 3 years in that position, and I was able to retire out of Sonoma State at age 50. So I did. I went to work at the local community college for 3 years doing disability technology, and found that I was really spoiled at Sonoma State. I had been able to find a way to be able to do my job really efficiently. I had three people working for, four people working for me. They did their job really efficiently. We were able to do a really good job, have the highest percentage of disabled students in the CSU system. And it gave me enough time to be able to be on national committees, to go off and do this, do the other thing, all while being paid at Sonoma State University. And it was also a time in universities where that was more thought favorable. You know, that if I went off to a national committee, I would bring something good back to Sonoma State. And that's not true in universities anymore. But it was a wonderful time. I got spoiled. I'm still completely spoiled. And so that once I left, well, when I was at the Santa Rosa Junior College, it was way too small a box. They knew who they were hiring. But once I got there, I know they really had second thoughts. You know, it's like, oh, this guy really is who he said he was, which is a troublemaker. You know, I knock shit off the shelves. That's what I do. So I lasted there 3 years and moved on. And since then, I've taken on a number of jobs, mostly consulting. I worked for the World Institute on Disability, which is an international policy organization. I'd always wanted to work for a think tank, and I got to. And I discovered that it really made my head hurt. You know, I worked with a whole bunch of people who were a lot smarter than I was. And at the end of the day, I was toast. You know, it was really exciting, and it was really draining. It was a lot of fun for 4 or 5 years. The money ran out. It's real hard to find money to do technology policy advocacy. You know, it's a lot easier to find money to fund a lab to train disabled teenagers than it is to find money to pay somebody to go to Washington, D.C. and knock on doors and say we need more broadband for people with disabilities. Mm. So the money ran out. So since then, I've been taking on a number of things. Right now, the two major parts of what I'm doing is, one is I'm working in the cultural arena of disability. And it's something that is very strong in England. England does not have very good civil rights for people with disabilities, but they're really strong on the cultural. I mean, they've got plays and performances and art shows and films all about disability from a positive disability perspective of what we would call in the U.S. a disability rights perspective. And that I find enormously exciting. And so I try and work with that arena, both within my photography as well as supporting others. I had a lecture series at the De Young Museum for 3 or 4 years where we tied the current exhibits into a disability perspective. So I did a lot of research on Henri Toulouse-Lautrec and did an hour lecture at the De Young on Henri Toulouse-Lautrec. It was very cool. And I was able to read his paintings through disability eyes. You know, it may not be accurate, but I saw a disabled person who was living in an able-bodied world. He was rich. I mean, he had privilege. He was white, male, but he was obviously disabled. He found living in brothels around women who are prostitutes to be a more comfortable environment than out in the world. And I understand that. I mean, in that kind of living in that women's world as a disabled person, it's more comforting in some ways. It's less threatening. You know, it projecting through what I read about him, I was able to see how, you know, he has this wonderful gaze upon women, this really tender view of women that I hadn't realized until I saw his paintings. You know, and it is there. It is so true. He has such a tender gaze, and it's wonderful. You know, and you compare that to Degas, who really did not like women. You know, and it's interesting to see the two, both on the surface look sexualized, but Degas were clearly sexualized, and Toulouse-Lautrec, there's a sexuality and sensuality. It's there, but it's a very loving gaze. The other thing I'm working on is how much time have we got? Can I get another 5?
That's exactly what you got.
Okay, good. oh, that is right. You're right. One of the things I've been working on lately is doing disability competency training. Cultural competence is one of the bywords these days. Talking to service providers it's not just to treat everybody like everybody else, but to really recognize the differences in various cultures. You know, here in California, huge populations that most service providers don't share their identity. You know, whether it's Hmong or Eritreans or Ukrainians or whatever. You know, and so to be aware of the cultural differences is important. And so one of the things that I've been doing since the early 1980s is working in the arena of alcohol and other drugs and disability. Hmm. I got sober in the early 80s. I'm definitely a child of the 60s. I'm part of the baby boomers, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, happy as a clam, you know. I like to drink. I like to do drugs. You know, it was, I loved the 70s. I loved the early 80s. They didn't particularly love me. And thank God the university had an employee assistance program that when I was screwing up so badly that they gave me a choice of either going to get counseling or getting fired. I chose counseling. Got sober and discovered it that deepened my understanding of who I was and what I was and helped me gain a spiritual perspective to my life and opened me up in yet another way. And I found another community. Those people who, alcoholics and drug addicts who don't drink and use.
Hmm.
You know, and that's another wonderful community like the disability community. And so through the 80s, I worked a lot on advocating for access to alcohol and other drug treatment for people with disabilities. Because it's just, people with disabilities are not intervened on, we're not referred to treatment. Once we get to treatment, there's residential treatment. There's very little residential treatment that's accessible for people with disabilities. Many of the prevention messages are don't drink and drive or you'll end up crippled, you know, which is just not a good message.
Yeah.
You know, you'll end up with this parking space if you drink and drive was one of them. And so throughout the 80s and most of the 90s, I was very much involved in these issues. And I was on a national committee, the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention. And it was, you know, I'd fly out to Washington every quarter. It was great fun. I loved it. And at some point, I got a little too radical there. I guess that's the arc of my story is I get a little too radical wherever I go. And at some point, somebody shows, I find the door. Actually, they don't show me the door, but I realize it's time for me to move on. And so once again, it was time for me to move on because I got a little too radical. You know, I'm really good at starting these things. But once I get there, I want to go further and people don't want to go further.
Hmm.
It's who I am. So, so in the, after the, 2000, you know, working for WID, doing technology, not a whole lot in the alcohol and drug world, but always in California, I've kind of been the recognized alcohol and drug and disability guy, particularly when the funding dried up in the state to fund any of that. There's a constituent committee. So when it came time to do cultural competence training, it was alcohol and other drug money. When they realized they should be doing disability, they came and found me. So that's what I've been doing the last 3 or 4 years is developing this concept of disability as a cultural community and how to look at cultural competence.
Hmm.
So it's not about just providing a ramp. You know, as important as the ramp is, it's for people with disabilities for us to recognize our own communities, our own strengths, our own weaknesses, what binds us together, whether that's music or art or film or the people we love, as well as for the people in our lives to recognize us as a community.
Mm.
You know, so in the United States, what I've come to realize is the disability community, we really define ourselves politically. Most people with disabilities would see themselves that the ADA those civil rights, that's what they share with other disabled people. Unlike England, where they see themselves as sharing a culture. You know, so I'm more like the English. I see both the cultural and the civil rights. So right now, that's where I'm trying to find ways to be able to present these ways of seeing, to organize things, to be able to bring these things to the forefront, you know, to be able to write, to photograph, you know, and I find various avenues where I'm able to do that. And something always comes up that where I can do it. So I'm very rarely bored.
That's a good thing.
Ta-da.
All right.